Welcome to episode 79 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. If you listened to episode 3 of the Focus Ring podcast that I did with three other Photocast Network members last month, you'll have heard that I visited the Chester Zoo one day during my visit to the UK in January and early February of 2007. I think shooting at zoos is a great way to hone your wildlife photography skills without the expense of going to the countries or exotic locations where many of the animals that you'll see actually live in the wild. Today I've selected a number of photos, 10 in total, from that afternoon to talk about, and this is going to be the first of a two-part series where I'm just going to basically go through talking about the photos and interweaving some tips and tricks on how to make most of your time at the zoo if you decide to take a trip yourself. Since first mentioning my zoo visit and the intention to do this podcast last month, there's been a bit of discussion on the forum about shooting in zoos. And also a while ago, I raised the point about whether or not shooting in zoos is ethical. And that was in a podcast way back. And there was a thread about that in the forum too. My own personal view on this is that any zoo worth its salt is probably doing a lot for conservation through breeding partnerships of endangered species and other programs. And the days of them, the zoos themselves, being cruel to animals or sort of locking them up in tiny compounds only to wheel them out for us to glare at during the days, I think those days are over. Indeed, if you believe you know of a zoo that might be being cruel to any of their animals, I suggest that you stop griping about the ethics of photographing their animals and get down to your local police station or Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals and report them. If you don't have any hang-ups about zoos, then I'm sure you'll agree that they are a great place to shoot and get invaluable practice shooting animals that would otherwise be impossible without actually getting on a plane and visiting an exotic location. Of course, if you turn up there without ever having photographed a wild animal, there are all sorts of issues that could prevent you from getting a decent shot. So, doing whatever you can to prepare beforehand with the help of your local zoo can save you time and money. Even if you're an experienced wildlife photographer, though, and you've got a lot of really sort of great shots in your portfolio already, it's probably just, the most important thing here is probably just that it's good fun. So, as I said in the introduction, today we're going to talk about, we'll take a look at a bunch of shots from my Chester Zoo trip, and I'll talk about some tricks, just plain advice that I can give to help you get great shots in similar conditions. The first tip, and this is something that I always try to do but don't always succeed, is if you have any wish to ID the animals or birds that you shoot at a later point, then take photographs of the nameplate or the information board, whatever what you want to call it, that's associated with the subject. You can, of course, just note it down, take a pad and do it nice and analog, or I sometimes use the stylus with my phone and write it on a pad as well. But I think I just find that just to stop the flow to do those things takes a little bit more time. So I generally just snap one photograph of the plaque just for the sake of remembering the name of the animal, bird or reptile, whatever that I'm about to shoot. I sometimes do it after I've shot it as well. I don't know that I'm going to shoot everything. I don't know if there's a photo opportunity there. So afterwards is fine too. So for the first photograph I'm going to show you, I'm going to totally contradict myself because I could not find a plaque. This is probably more from lack of searching properly on my side, but You know, believe me, I've spent a lot of time trying to ID this animal after the event. And I've even emailed Chester Zoo. They've been kind enough to give me the name of 2 out of 4 of the animals. There was 3 that I wasn't sure of, and 1 that I was kind of sure of, but not enough to just to tell you that, to title the photograph with that. So I emailed Chester Zoo. They've been incredibly good and told me the name of 2 of the 4 photographs, the animals in 4 photographs that I sent them. They themselves don't know the one for this, and they've told me they're going to get back to me. It's obviously, I don't think it's the whole zoo doesn't know, obviously, but the person that replied to me didn't have the information on this particular bird, which is not all that surprising. There's a lot of animals there. So I don't know if the guys over at Chester Zoo are going to listen to this, but if you do, thanks for your help in naming the 2. Hope I can get the name of the other 2. But also that the thing that I'd like to say here as well is they are probably not all that happy about having to help me out getting the names for these things, for these animals. They haven't complained, but if I go and tell you that this is an option, then they're probably not going to be very happy, because it's they don't want to be overwhelmed with photographers asking them to ID their animals for them or for you. So basically, do what you can to find out the names, to make a note of the names. I always try to as much as possible. The reason that I went to the extent of actually asking them is because I'm going to make this public podcast about that. I explained this to them in the email, and I probably wouldn't have bothered them for this just if it was for, if it wasn't going to be something that I'd publish. So anyway, I couldn't find the name of the bird that we're about to look at, but let's take a look at image number 1312, and we can see a beautiful white bird, which, basically I wanted to talk about here. Despite the beautiful clarity of this shot, I captured it through a mesh fence. The mesh was relatively dense, and I also couldn't get that close to it, to the mesh, that is. I'd say that there was at least 2 or 3 feet, that's about 1 meter, I suppose, from me to the fence, but it has not registered at all in the image. Now, most of you will already know what I did here, but for those that don't, we can magically make these things disappear to a degree by simply using a wide aperture. This is really only going to work, though, when the subject is also a reasonable distance from the mesh. I haven't tested this, but I'd say that you need the mesh to be at least halfway between you and the subject to make this work. If it's much closer to the subject than it is far from you, then you'll probably start having problems. Ideally, you want the mesh just really as close as possible, but I would say that halfway, perhaps less, a little less, is probably the limit. Another thing to note is that the first thing I start showing see the problems with, in my experience at least, is not the subject, but the bokeh, or the out of focus areas around the subject. This starts to become adversely affected and textured by the mesh. You know, you get like a shape. Say if it's a diamond shape mesh, then you get diamond shapes there in the bokeh before you see it on the subject. If you're shooting with a compact digital, or a lens that doesn't open up to a very wide aperture, then you might start seeing this effect even with the aperture wide open. I shot this image with my 70-200mm f2.8 lens with the 1.4x extender fitted, and the aperture was set to wide open for this combination, which is f4. An extender is what Canon calls teleconverters, by the way, for those of you that aren't familiar with the terminology. This is at the full range. It was shot at 280mm focal length, which allowed me to fill the frame with the subject. The f4 aperture was enough, as I say, to totally remove any trace of the fence, and yet still get a beautiful detail around the eyes, and indeed the face, the beak, the neck, and the rest of the subject. It's, although the mesh is there, you just really wouldn't know. It also throws the green grass in the background into just slightly mottled green, like patches of brown mottled in there, which stops it from becoming a distraction. Note that for most of the shots we'll look at today, all but the last one, I think, I was using aperture priority mode. And because this bird is mostly white, I added 2/3 of a stop exposure compensation. It was an overcast day, so, you know, it was pretty dull, which meant that I didn't really want to overdo the compensation. Had this bird been in full sunlight, much brighter, I'd probably have needed to go to more like one stop. But, you know, on this day, plus 2/3 was fine. Basically, though, it's necessary to bear this in mind when filling the frame with a mostly white subject. I've been into details of this theory many times in the podcast as well, though, so I'm not going to go into that too much today. So note also that all images from the day were shot handheld. I'm not sure if it's okay to use a tripod at Chester Zoo. I couldn't find any information on their website. I had my tripod with me just because it was attached to my bag. But, you know, basically, I checked the website, which, by the way, I'll put a link to in the show notes just in case you want to go over and take a look yourself. Either way, even if it doesn't say that it's not allowed, most of the time, I'd say that zoos, you know, they're pretty busy places, and even if it is not against the rules, you'd be better off planning on shooting by hand, you know, handheld. You'd probably quickly start to annoy other visitors if you start setting up a tripod, and the chances are that they'd start kicking the legs anyway right at the time you don't want them to, and they'd just sort of start to try to annoy you right back. So, anyway, that aside, the next shot I wanted to look at is image number 1314, in which we can see two black rhinos in a pretty cool face-off kind of pose. These two kept sort of butting each other in a show of power, which was really quite cool to watch, with the dull thud of the horns clashing together alongside the grunts of these incredibly powerful animals. In a talk by one of the zoo staff, we heard that Chester Zoo are heavily involved in conservation with a number of partners, one of which actually has a number of rangers in Kenya helping to protect the black rhino and its habitat. This is something that is made possible by redirecting the admission fees and donations from visitors in such a way. This is great news in not only for the fact that it's a very good cause. It also helps to dispel the myth that zoos are just cruel places, and you know the animals are only there because they're interested in making money. I personally think it's an excellent way for zoos to give back, and for us also to help support conservation while having a great day out at the same time. We also heard that black rhino and white rhino cannot be easily told apart by their colours, interestingly enough. According to the zoo staff, they are both pretty similar in colour, kind of like an 18% grey card, really, which makes exposure really easy if you fill the frame with a rhino. I'm thinking it might be a good idea to get one to replace my Y-bar card. No, maybe not. So, seriously though, the main difference is, as you can see in this photo, the black rhino have a triangular-shaped, kind of pointed lip. It sort of hangs down there. Whereas the white rhino we hear, that grazes on grass, has a squarer mouth. The black rhino apparently has developed the pointed triangular lip as it grazes on forest, the thorn shrub that you find in forest as opposed to grass. I did actually select minus one stop of exposure compensation for this shot, so I am really joking about the grey card thing. But you know, it was indoors and it was relatively dim, so I cranked up the ISO to 800 and with an aperture of f4, again with the 70 to 200 millimeter with a 1.4 extender, I was getting a shutter speed of 1/25th of a second. Way too slow for sensible photography, and I got a number of images that were not great. They were a little blurred. But in the moments when the animals stopped moving before another headbutting session, it was possible to capture this shot and a few similar ones. There are, by the way, other images There's another one of the rhinos and a load of others that are on my website from this day. And I'll put a link so that you can sort of list all of those up into the show notes for this episode. And we'll cover another bunch next week as well. So really, what was happening here, they'd got like a wooden enclosure around the rhino compound. So there was nothing between us and the rhinos. There was no mesh to get rid of. But basically, I was just sort of leaning on the wooden fence around the enclosure, which also helped me to stabilize the camera at such slow shutter speeds. Of course, I was using the lens's image stabilizer feature. If you're wondering what kind of lens to buy for this sort of shooting, if you don't already have something that's relatively long, you can see that I'm using up to 280 millimeters. This is not really for want of a little more. I left my 100 to 400 millimeter lens in Japan when I went to the UK. I wish I hadn't, but the 1.4 extender with the 70-200 does give me a good option. But basically, you're going to want something up to, you know, one of the 70 to 300 millimeter lenses is fine. That will get you pretty close. And the one that Canon has right now, I believe Nikon 2 does have image stabilization. So great option if you were thinking of something for shooting in zoos and you're not already kitted out. The 100 400 millimeter is also an excellent lens, and I would have loved to have had it on this day. I really just was trying to cut down on weight for the trip to England, and photography of this kind was not on the venue originally, so I kind of just sort of slipped up in my planning here. Anyway, when you do buy a lens, image stabilization might bump up the cost a little bit, but it can often make the difference between getting the shot and not. So, you know, bear that in mind when you're out kitting yourself out. So moving on to the next image, let's look at number 1316, in which you'll see a close-up of an emu. Another portrait-type shot. This image was shot through mesh, again, a really quite thick wire, or it might have even been metal slats, if I recall correctly, but very thick. And I had to place the lens so that the center of the lens was sort of right in the middle of the mesh there. I could get right up to this one, not like the one with the white bird. I could get right up to this one so that the only distance between the front element of my lens and the opening in the mesh was the distance for the lens hood. I could probably have taken the lens hood off without too much worry of glare or, you know, the light hitting the front element, because it was an overcast day. But I kind of am just in the habit of leaving that on, and it doesn't really make much. It didn't make much difference in this situation either. But basically, make sure that I was shooting right through the middle of the hole in the mesh, and that gave me a clear line of sight to the emu's eye. You know, by doing that, I was just pretty much able again to make the mesh disappear, and let's see, shooting details for this are f4 for ISO 400 and that at 233 millimeters focal length with minus 2/3 of exposure compensation again, just basically gave me the results that you see here. This is really just another example of shooting through the mesh, and I'd like to just reinforce the idea of getting your subject's eyes sharp. This kind of wide open aperture photography might not be for everyone, but to me, as long as you get those eyes sharp, the overall soft effect of the rest of the image is quite pleasing. One other thing that I wanted to touch on with the next shot of the same subject is, let's see, image number 1315. And that is the importance of keeping your eyes open for something a little bit different, not just in zoos, but whenever you're out with your camera. Although it's important to get the eyes sharp if they're included, there's no rule that says that you have to put an animal's eyes in the shot in the first place. When this emu turned around and showed me the back of its head, I remember just chuckling to myself at how comical he looked, and couldn't resist getting this image of the back of his head. I'd zoomed in slightly to 250mm, but still at f4, so the shot is very soft with a totally green, even green background. But we can see enough detail in those hairs, and you know, I've captured those nice blue patches on the side of the head, even though they're soft, which all really just helps to make this shot work. Let's look now at image number 1317, in which we can see a beautiful specimen of a Geoffroy's marmoset. This is, in fact, one of the photographs that the people at Chester Zoo helped me to ID, so thanks again for that. It's a really handsome fellow, or fellowette, I'm not sure, obviously, whether it's a male or female. I'm sure there are markings that can show me that, but I'm not an expert on these animals. But whatever, you know, it's just such a beautiful, handsome animal to look at. I found from the Bristol Zoo website, actually, while I was trying to ID these, after I'd ID'd it, actually, because I looked it up with the name, I found that these marmosets are from Brazil and are one of a few species that specializes in feeding on tree sap. The marmosets first bite through and they sort of chew a hole in the tree's bark to start the sap flowing. And then the tree tries to sort of stop the flow, by producing gums and resins and latex, what have you. And then that's sort of to like a scab, really, if a human cuts yourself. But then the marmosets sort of, after having their first feed, they'll return to the holes later, eat the gum covering, and then eat the sap that starts to flow again. Anyway, I shot this again with the 70 to 200 millimeter with the 1.4 times extender, with the aperture wide open again at f4. This gave me a shutter speed of 1/30th of a second at ISO 400. Again, very slow. This one I wasn't resting on anything. This was just pure handheld. So again, no mesh to contend with. Just a clear run at the subject. About 12 feet or so away from me, about 3.7 meters. I still used a wide aperture, the widest aperture, just simply because I like the aesthetic that this type of photography gives. Years ago, I used to shoot all sorts of apertures just to cover my bases, but I found more and more that I was always just using the image that had the widest aperture to get the part of the subject in the shot that I really needed in focus, such as the eyes here. And I really didn't care all that much if the detail in the fur is very sharp or not. And I find that the background being in sharp focus, which is what happens if you try to get the whole subject in focus as well, the background being not so much sharp focus, but very, the detail showing up very much, it just really doesn't appeal to me that much. So I tend to use as wide an aperture as I can get away with, to give me this kind of look. I know that the marmoset is covered in fur. And, you know, I can see enough detail in the shot to confirm that. So to me, you know, the soft surrounding with those tack sharp eyes is much more to my liking. This is not always going to be the case, of course. You may disagree, and that's your prerogative. This is just my taste. So let's look at something interesting now, though. With regards to the depth of field, I tend to get in pretty close with most of my subjects, as you've probably noticed. And again, with this last shot, it's been a portrait. These again, initially, I selected to talk about just because I really like them. I prefer to see a portrait of an animal rather than a documentary shot with the whole animal visible. But I do still shoot like full body shots as much because I think that they might be successful, even though I usually prefer the portrait, but just really for the sake of it. And, you know, what I did here was I took a number of shots as well. They're on my website, and I've included two more here. I wasn't going to originally, but I did to make this point about depth of field. So let's take a look at the two more to emphasize the effect that the distance to subject has on the, not so much the distance to subject, With the same distance to subject, just by changing the field of view, the focal length of your camera, we can see how the depth of field changes. I was pretty much standing on the same spot. So, take a look before we do move on at how shallow the depth of field is on this particular subject in this shot. You can see that the background is totally blurred, green and brown. And there's no detail to be made out in the background whatsoever. And you can see as well that the face, there's really the eyes and just a few centimeters behind the eyes and in front of the eyes. The nose and mouth looks very slightly out of focus as well. So you can appreciate how shallow the depth of field is. And then let's take a look at image number 1318, which was shot at exactly the same distance to subject with the same aperture f.4. Now you'll see that we do not only have more of the subject itself looking very sharp, but we can now make out more detail in the background. This is because the focal length has been changed from 280 millimeters in the last shot to just under half that at 130 millimeters. Although still out of focus, the bokeh in the background has more detail, more identifiable patches of green and brown than the last. And to further this, let's open the the fo well shorten the focal length a little bit more. And to display that, let's take a look at image number 1319. Again, taken from the same distance to subject, though this time, like I say, the focal length was shorter. I was shooting at 73 millimeters here, and you can see that all of the subject is included, with its long tail, and all of the subject is now in sharp focus, and we can make out much more of the background now. We can see the branches and leaves, although not totally sharp, but enough to make out without doubt what they are. This helps us to see the surroundings in which the marmoset is living, but they're out of focus enough to stop them from becoming a total distraction. So, I've sort of flipped through these photos really quickly, but I just wanted to make a point for some of the listeners that might not really understand the relationship. But depth of field is, it's very much based on lots of different things. And you don't have to sort of change the aperture to change the depth of field. If you change the focal length to a wider one, then you can see very easily how it affects the depth of field in these three shots. It wasn't planned, but I just thought I'd mention this as I had three shots of different, basically halving the focal length each time from the same spot. So I just thought I'd throw that in. So to give you an idea of the actual depth of field, I fired up Barnek. Barnek is a free Windows utility that I've used. I've mentioned it in previous podcasts. It's used for calculating depth of field, hyperfocal distance, etc. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes in case you don't already have a copy. I'm not sure exactly how far away I was. I said 12 feet or 3.7 meters. I didn't measure it. I don't know exactly. But I used that for my calculations, and I'm going to just tell you now what the actual depth of field should have been if I was at those standing at that distance. So for the first shot at 280 millimeters, f/4 would have given me a depth of field of around 4 centimeters, and that looks about right. That seems about right. Maybe a little bit less, so I might have been a little bit closer. When I changed to 130 millimeters focal length, the same as the second image, that Barnack tells me that I had a depth of field of 19 centimeters, so quite a lot more there. And then when I go even wider, to 73 millimeters, I'm told that I get a depth of field of 61 centimeters. So again, much more. 61 centimeters is 24 inches. So you can appreciate how much wider it gets with each halving of the focal length. So, like I say, it's just really to give you an idea. Anyway, moving on. Let's talk. Let's see, three more pictures I want to talk about. Again, I'm not usually one for showing the same multiple pictures of the same shot, same subject. But again, there are things that I want to talk about here, so just sort of you can stick with me. We'll just take a look at these three more today, and then we'll move on and leave the rest for next week. But let's look now at image number 1321, in which we can see another beautiful bird, which is a peacock. This guy was just sort of sitting on the grass inside his compound, and was, you know, it was very close to me, maybe just over a meter, about 4 feet or so from me. Again, I was able to lean on the wooden enclosure to stabilize my camera, to minimize camera shake, which helped me to get this crystal clear portrait of a stunning creature. You can see I'm right up close. Again, you know, he's looking right back at me here. I actually make this look pretty easy from this one shot, but he was almost in constant motion, preening his feathers and just generally spinning that head around all over the place. I had a number of shots in which he just hadn't kept still, and so they contained motion blur ruining the image. I was really quite close, like I said, so I closed the aperture down just a little to f5. I actually took the next shot that we're going to look at before this, and that was at f5.6. But at this point, I'd closed the aperture down to, opened the aperture up to f5. And with an ISO of 400, this was giving me a shutter speed of 1/200th of a second. Again, I was exposure compensating to the tune of -1 stop, so that the scene didn't get too bright in the dull daylight. You'll notice again that I have really just gotten in close. You don't have to do this yourself. It's just the way I like to shoot. By all means, you can go and shoot the whole bird if you can get it in. I tried and I was just not happy with the results. I could see too much of the detail around the bird in the grass and the foliage behind it for my liking. The reason I decided to include more than one shot of this peacock is again to emphasize the benefits of looking for an alternative angle. In image number 1320, you can see that I closed in on a small portion of the peacock's tail. Those beautiful eye-like markings make for a great subject all on their own, and a few people would not be able to recognize them like this. Here I was paying close attention to the positioning of the eye marks. As I said earlier, I took this in reverse order. We've just looked at them in reverse order. I was still at f5.6 when I shot this, and that basically gave me just a little bit more depth of field than the last shot that we were going to look at and the next one. I positioned the two primary markings diagonally in the frame, one top right there and the other one just off center but towards bottom left. The other markings are forming kind of an arc leading our eye around the shot so that we can investigate the details, and the textures there are made up of all of those not just the markings themselves, but all of those fibrous strands of feathers. In the next shot, image number 1325, I basically reduced the aperture, as I said, for the first and this shot to f5. And that really made the eye-light markings a secondary, more out-of-focus subject. They're very dominant, so I think that if they were in focus, our eye would not have even gone to the back of the shot here. But I was trying to bring the beautiful feathers at the top of the peacock's back between the wings into basically the fore, even though they're at the back of the shot. This was shot at the full extent of the 70-200mm 2.8 with the 1.4 times extender, again at ISO 400. And as I mentioned at the very beginning, this is the first shot that I'd actually switched to manual. I'd been shooting, finding that aperture priority was fine for most of the day. And because I was sort of moving inside of buildings and outside for the next shot, it's just basically easier to stick it in aperture priority mode. But the, you know, one, I found that this guy was just sort of moving around. He'd got different sort of colors, different luminance out of various parts of his body. And it was just sort of basically playing up with the exposure that I was getting. So I decided to flick to manual. I based it on a, as I usually do when I do this, based it on the last shot that I'd noticed that was the exposure that I wanted. I just reset the manual mode to those, the exposure and aperture that I was looking at there, and just continue to take a few more shots. And really, that's about it for this first of a two-part episode on my visit to the Chester Zoo. I hope that if this was not already something that you're aware of, you'll be able to appreciate how much fun shooting at a zoo can be, but also how much this can help to prepare for shooting real wildlife, that is, animals in the wild as opposed to captive ones. Some of the tips, like using a wide aperture to shoot through mesh, would not, of course, really help you when shooting in natural surroundings. That's really just for shooting at zoos. But you could be in the situation where, say, there was some fine foliage or grasses between you and your subject. You couldn't stand up or get you know, in front of the grasses for fear of startling the subject, and you might need to make that disappear. The fact of the matter is, for the majority of wildlife photography, because you need a fast shutter speed, you're often going to be shooting with a wide aperture anyway. But it's good to sort of know how much you can get away with and how much you can't. And of course, this is the only real way to make shooting at a zoo viable. But anyway, I hope you can appreciate the fact that it's good practice. You become more confident with your gear before faced with a moving subject that will perhaps only grace itself, grace yourself with its presence for a fleeting moment before disappearing into the distance, never to return. And in those sort of situations, the excitement can be quite overwhelming. And if you start fumbling around with your gear because you don't know it that well, because you haven't had much practice with it, then you can lose your chance very easily. And that's incredibly frustrating. So, you know, these are the main reasons why I would say, you know, let's get to the zoo. Of course, it's a great day out. If you go with your family, you'll have problems sort of holding them back while you're trying to make photographs. It'd be good if you could set times, say meet them at the elephant house in an hour's time, stuff like that. Give yourself pockets of time to enjoy yourself. You know, there are things that you can do to make that work. But also, you know, going alone or going with other like-minded people is another thing that we could, you know, try out to make this a more beneficial exercise. So either way, I hope you have fun with it if you do go. I know that a lot of people are enjoying this, and I hope that this has been of some use for those that do or intend to go to zoos to practice our wonderful art. So next week I'll interweave a few more tips as they become sort of relevant, and I'll be including tips for shooting through glass, because I've got a few shots in which I shot through glass to talk about next week. And you know, basically, we'll do a similar sort of thing to this week, probably a similar number of photographs. A little bit long. I'm seeing that I'm almost up to 40 minutes now, so a longer episode than I was expecting. But hopefully, you'll think it's been worthwhile. So, thanks for listening again today. I've been receiving more encouraging email lately than I have done to date. Many people are telling me how much they appreciate the effort that I put into creating these podcasts, and how much they look forward to each episode and sort of variations of the same. And I've got to say that I really appreciate you taking the time to let me know these things. I'm always open for a pat on the back, and I'm always open for ideas on how I could possibly improve the podcast as well. So, you know, please do keep these mails coming. I have to say, one or two people have mailed me recently as well, saying that they're in the middle of a marathon listening session to catch up on all of the archives. And I have to say that my hat goes off to each and every one of you that is in the middle of that exercise. I really appreciate everyone taking the time to listen to each individual episode and to listen to all of them to date. You know, we're talking with today 79 episodes and counting. It's really a test of stamina if ever there was one. So thanks very much to all of the people that are doing that. And again, just for everyone for listening all the time. I really do appreciate your support. If you do appreciate what I'm doing or you think it's useful, if you could drop an email to friends, colleagues, or anyone that you think might be interested as well, that'll help to spread the word. So with that, though, I'll sign off for today. Have a great week, whatever you're doing, if you're out doing photography, or, you know, just basically whatever you're doing. Have a great time doing it. Bye-bye.
PhotoCastNetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. PhotoCastNetwork.com.